This is your prophecy update with host John Holler.
Let's pray. Lord, thank you so much for a beautiful day today. We pray that you will watch over us. Pray you'll give us insight and understanding into the rapid acceleration of events that we see in the world today. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, today I'm going to talk about the new abnormal. Because if you haven't noticed, things are not normal anymore. They are not like they were 2 months ago. They aren't even like they were 6 weeks ago. And I don't think that they're going to go back to what they were like 6 weeks ago anytime soon. So today I'm going to look at, in particular, the current convergence of events, mainly some things related to the coronavirus outbreak, how people are dealing with that, and the economic impact, and then have some other comments about the things that people are taking advantage of the situation, I guess is the best way to state it, to put in some of their agenda. For many years, I've been using these covers from Foreign Policy magazine, Can We Fix This in a World Disrupted? I will also say that I'm not going to get through even a smidgen of all the things I've been reading this week that I think are significant and important. I did do some interviews. I think one's up at in talks with some other people. I think one is up at GCR TV. I think I also did something one night with some people from Freedom Fellowship Church down in Florida. And I also did Stand Up for the Truth with David Fiorazzo on Q90 FM in Wisconsin on Thursday. So that's why I didn't do a midweek update this week, because I was talking too much already. It is a very troubling world. Let me give you a couple of verses that I want to just sort of set the stage. This is a verse I used last week. For thus saith the Lord of hosts, yet once it is a little while, and I will shake the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry land, and I will shake all nations, and the desire of all nations shall come. And I will fill this house with glory, saith the Lord of hosts. And certainly there's no question but that a lot of things that we held dear, like work, like sporting events, recreational events, visits with family, visits with others, all of those things have sort of been shaken and taken away from us in today's world. It's also referenced something similar referenced in Luke chapter 21, verse 25. And there shall be signs in the sun and in the moon and in the stars, and upon the earth distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring, men's hearts failing them for fear and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of heaven shall be shaken. Now, this verse refers in many respects to something yet even future from now. But you're going to see these type of things, I think, happen more and more as we lead up to that period of time when everything will really be shaken. It's just going to be the new abnormal. It's going to be what we're going to have to live with, I think. I really don't see at this point that things will go back. Now, there's a lot of concern, even fear out there on all sides of this issue. Departing, it doesn't make any difference how you come down on it. And if you don't agree with somebody, everybody, you know, you're not as strong in the faith as they are, and you don't have the understanding that they do. This is a very difficult thing to discern exactly what it is that's going on. But God made a promise to us in 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 7. It says, for God hath not given us the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. So we need to focus on some of these. We should not be driven by a spirit of fear. And we should use the sound mind that God promised that he would give us. And as I have been, as I mentioned last week, I have been, I would say, inundated with a lot of articles and videos, literally in the hundreds and hundreds of videos people have sent me And I appreciate that, but I don't have, obviously, time to review everything that is sent my way. Sometimes I will get the same video sent to me 10 times within a space of 5 minutes. So I do sort of take a high overview of a lot of them, but I don't have time. I apologize. I just don't have time to vet them. I think some people send them to me because they want my opinion as to whether the thing is valid. I will say that, you know, my profession for 40 years has been a trial lawyer. I have to review a lot of information and putting a case together for a trial. Sometimes it's very complex and hard to piece together. And I will say that I have seen a lot of things that trouble me. I see people citing bad sources. I would vet your sources that you cite before you pass the information on. I have not yet seen anybody citing AOC as a source yet, but I expect to see that in the next week or so. But I've seen people who hold to much of her ideology that are being cited, and that's troubling. I also see a tremendous amount of people being quoted incorrectly, connections made that I don't think should be made. And I hate to point it out because then people say, well, you're just defending so-and-so. And I'm not defending so-and-so. I care about Christians accurately quoting people. And I think it is a big problem. And I don't think you can always make your case, but I think you do great damage to your case when you cite questionable sources, even though they agree with you on one topic. You need to look into that a little bit further before you just cite them. I would almost call that sort of a tickling ear syndrome, that you look for things that make you feel comfortable. And this is very easy to do in the environment that we live in, because it is very uncomfortable. And everybody is in this at many different levels. Some people it's not having a huge impact on. Others it's devastating, not only from a health standpoint, but also increasingly from an economic standpoint. And things are happening that are just so outside the normal range of human experience that we've always come to know. And I'll talk a little bit about those. Here's just some interesting statistics and things that are going on in the new abnormal. Cell phone data shows vast majority of churchgoers stayed home on Easter. Now, this is interesting. This is an article from this morning's Washington Post. And the article is probably correct that attendance on Easter was down somewhere around 75% or more compared to what it was in the past for people who regularly go to church. Now, there's a couple interesting takeaways from this article. Of course, we can talk about, hey, attendance is down at church. But I also think that the headline of the article tells us something that I find to be very troubling. And this is along the lines of privacy and tracking and all of this other stuff that's coming along. The headline of the article says, cell phone data shows vast majority of churchgoers stayed home on Easter. Now, how do they know all the cell phones of all the people who went to church last year and this year? In other words, I know there is great concern, and Pastor Steve has sort of alluded to it in his message today and will next week, and I did last week. There is this legitimate concern, I think, about the mark of the beast. What is the mark of the beast? When is the mark of the beast coming? But I will tell you, I have been studying Bible prophecy for all of my life, over 60 years. I have been taught it since a young child. Hal Lindsey's book came out in 1970, 50 years ago. And I would say that there have been at least two dozen, if not more, things that have been presented over time as this is absolutely, without question, no doubt, the mark of the beast. So when I see, and although I see some things, and I'm going to talk about one today or a couple of them today. And so last week I mentioned a quantum dot tattoo, and I said I didn't think it was the mark of the beast. And I've gotten some of the most vicious, vitriolic responses to that statement. And my question is, where's the beast? Because it's called the mark of the beast. Now, I know there are a lot of things that lead up to it. And for 50 years, we've been tracking all of those things, and we may be getting closer and closer, but I don't think that anybody can definitively say, and I have gotten, I don't even have the count of the emails I've got this week, that this is the mark of the beast. But I've seen those communications and articles for 50 years. I think we're getting closer. I think all of this stuff is happening. And one of these is the ability to track people. So here is, how do they know who's going to church? And the answer is they have databases of vast amounts of information of what you're doing with your time and everything. Again, this happens all the time. I mentioned in passing something to my wife. I can't even remember what it was. Maybe we're going to repair the deck or fix up the deck in the back of the house. And immediately in my Facebook feed yesterday, I have advertisements for people to rebuild my deck, paint my deck. It's just a coincidence, I'm sure. It's just it's one of those things that just happens. So, look, this is a big area of concern that they are tracking you. But understand, they're doing this without implants or anything like this. They're doing it because we all carry a tracking device around in our pocket. Let's go into this. So these are headlines from different newspapers in the U.S. and the U.K. And I focus on those a lot because they're in English and I read English more easily than anything else. Record weekly death toll as fearful patients avoid hospitals. Weekly death toll worst on record. Number of deaths being undercounted. New statistics indicate cancer treatment will be the next NHS crisis. And so what we see here is we see the, not only are people dying from the coronavirus, and I do believe people are dying from the coronavirus, they may have a secondary condition that leads to it, just like when they die from the regular flu, they have a secondary condition, but it's called they died from the flu. It's the way they track statistics, and the statistics are not correct. They, in the initial stages, they're not perfect. You're in the midst of a pandemic and you're taking care of people, and there's guidance put out about how to look at the to record and code things, certificates, and I get all that, and it's not perfect. And sometimes these statistics are revised. In fact, you're already seeing some revisions. I'll talk about that in just a moment. But one of the things that's happening that they've noticed this in Italy, in New York City, and other places where this virus has broken out, is there has been a spike in deaths. In fact, here's an example. This is a chart from New York City. Deaths are more than double expected total. So what they did was they took the average number of deaths, or the number of deaths in a month, and they tracked it back to about the year 2000. And you'll see, and this is just in New York City, so you see in September 2001, there was a spike up to 7,000 deaths. That was because about 2,800 people or so died in New York on September 11th, 2001. So that was a spike. And you'll see spikes, that some of those are seasonal spikes, because more people get sick and die in the winter and bad weather and that type of thing. But the interesting thing in this chart, in the month ending April 4, 30 days ending April 4, there were 9,780 deaths, whereas the usual number is somewhere around 4,500, 4,800, under 5,000 a day. I mean, 5,000 a month. And so the question is, what caused all of those excess deaths? September 11th, that's a pretty easy one to figure out because you got almost 3,000 in one day. But here we have 9,780 deaths in the 30 days ending April 4. And so this number is going to be spiked because of the number of deaths happening in New York City from the coronavirus over the past week or so, or the past month. Well, and the additional deaths that have happened over the past week. So it's a real moving target, but that's one of the things that people are noticing is there seem to be a lot more people dying. In New York City, for example, the normal number of in-home deaths on a daily basis averages between 20 and 25 people every day. Since the beginning of March, that number has been 10 times or more that amount. So people in public health and that look at death statistics, they're trying to figure out what's causing that. Now, one obvious answer is, well, it's coronavirus, but I don't think it's fair to say that that's all coronavirus. And in fact, I'll go back to this article at the from the Times of London, cancer treatment will be the next NHS crisis. But first, let me talk about the Financial Times article, weekly death toll worst on record. Now, again, they're not attributing everything to the coronavirus, but it's sort of the impact of how people are dealing with the coronavirus. Here's what it says. The impact of coronavirus was laid bare in figures showing the highest rate of deaths in England and Wales in a single week since records began, with fatalities involving COVID-19 much higher than the government daily figures. In the week ending April 3, the Office for National Statistics, now this is in the UK, received registrations of 16,000 deaths, 6,082 higher than the average for that week in the past 5 years. The high levels of mortality across England and Wales confirmed data from Public Health England last week that deaths were far higher than normal and off the usual scale for its charts. Again, in the upper right-hand corner, a headline from the Times of London. Record weekly death tolls. Fearful patients avoid hospitals. England and Wales have experienced a record number of deaths in a single week, with 6,000 more than average for this time of year. Only half of those extra numbers were attributed to the coronavirus. Experts said that they were shocked by the rise, particularly in non-COVID-19 deaths, and expressed concern that the lockdown might be having unintended consequences for people's health. And this is one of the problems. Not only is it causing economic devastation, it's also having a related health problem. They've shut down most of the hospitals. And so you will see pictures of empty hospitals, and they're focusing on one particular aspect. And they've told people to stay away. They even tell people who, I mean, I've read, I don't know how many stories this week of people talking about the death of their husband or wife, saying they were having trouble breathing. They had 104 temperature. They said, well, don't come here unless you can't breathe. And they take them there, and then they put them in an ambulance, and they die at the hospital from the coronavirus and the related pneumonia that seems to track along with it. But the point is that it's not just people that have the coronavirus that are being told to stay away from the hospital. It's people who need cardiac care, cancer treatment, surgeries, all sorts of things, even just general health care. And so this, I think, is causing, so where I think there are coronavirus deaths, there's also a spike of just deaths from other causes because of the change in healthcare all of a sudden. And I think some people are finally getting this. In Britain, they said number of deaths being undercounted, new statistics escalate. The terrifying conclusion, this article says, from the Times of London, must be that there will be a non-COVID health crisis when this pandemic is over. Far more will suffer and die from otherwise treatable conditions as many go undiagnosed and untreated for the next 6 months. Their families will not forgive or forget. Matt Hancock, the health secretary, refuses to give a figure for this potential non-COVID fatalities from this catastrophe, but the cabinet, that's the governing cabinet in the UK government, was told it could be up to 150,000 of avoidable deaths. So that's sort of, we don't just have a problem with COVID-19, we have a problem in healthcare in general, and at some point this COVID thing will taper off, I believe, but we're going to still be stuck with this. And things are happening that are very unusual. I have a good friend, her adult daughter had a brain tumor and had to go in for surgery this week. She was not allowed to see her daughter before surgery or after surgery. Pray for her. Her daughter is still in a coma. It was an incredibly complex tumor near or attached to one of the most important nerves, probably the most complex nerve in your body, as a matter of fact. And the question is she going to be able to see? Is she even going to survive this? And it's incredibly troubling to people that are having to deal with this situation. I know, Pastor Steve, your dad was in the hospital for 2 months, and you couldn't go see him for the last 6 weeks or so. Now, praise the Lord, he's home, I see. But that is, this is so abnormal from the human experience. I know friends who have parents in nursing homes. They cannot go see their parents, and they're the only people who ever interact with their parents outside of the staff. This is totally contrary to human experience and activity, and it's a big problem. And so cancer treatment in the UK, which some people have told me is not that good anyway, is going to be even worse because of the things that are going on here with regard to this particular crisis. People aren't going to get treated for several months. They're not even going to get diagnosed. And so many of those people may have a treatable cancer that could be helped by medication, alternative therapy, or surgery, and they're not getting that care, and it's completely blown the system apart. And I think it's one of those things where, they shut down everything other than COVID-19 pretty much, or emergency surgeries. And now we have this major crisis with regard to all of these things. Here's another article from yesterday's Wall Street Journal. The hidden toll of untreated illnesses. Most weeks at my hospital, this is written by a doctor in New York City. Most weeks at my hospital near New York, we see about 40 acute or near acute heart attacks. For the past few weeks, we've seen an average of 5, a 90% drop. We're hardly alone. At Detroit Medical Center, the number of heart attacks being treated has dwindled from 15 or 20 a week or two a week to 1 or 2. This is things that medical professionals have never seen in their experience. Hospitals in Atlanta and Boston have seen similar drops. The decline is also being observed abroad. In Milan, in the Lombardy region of Italy, for example, the number of heart attack cases is down by 70%. In Madrid, the dip may be closer to 80%. The downturn seems to be true for a range of medical conditions besides heart attacks. Case volumes have plummeted for appendicitis, gallbladder infections, and obstetric emergencies. To name just a few conditions that reliably appear in emergency rooms in non-pandemic times. Eerie and worrisome is how a hospital physician on the West Coast described it. People aren't coming in for strokes either. We're seeing less than half the number we normally see, a neurologist told me. What is happening? This doctor says this. Is the coronavirus pandemic somehow stabilizing health across a range of medical conditions? Given what we know about the virus, that doesn't seem plausible. Is society's response to the pandemic, such as social distancing, reducing exposure to pollution or other germs that can exacerbate chronic conditions? Such a hypothesis might explain some of the reduction in cardiovascular cases, but the sudden and simultaneous disappearance of so many hospitalizable conditions suggests that a social or behavioral factor is at play. Could it be that patients with medical emergencies are staying away from hospitals out of fear of viral transmission? He also noted that in Africa, when they had one of the Ebola outbreaks, hospital visits declined 90% during that time. He also references an article from an Italian paper, a picture of which you have here, that showed that those consequences may already be unfolding. In hard-hit regions in Italy, the death rate is currently 6 times higher than in comparable earlier periods. A study published in the Italian newspaper Corriere della Sera recently looked at the spike in deaths in Nembro, a town in Lombardy severely affected by the coronavirus. The report suggests that the deaths directly attributable to the coronavirus may account for only about a quarter of the rise. A portion of the excess deaths may be the result of undetected coronavirus infections, but more Many more are probably occurring because people have non-coronavirus diseases that aren't receiving proper care. Judging from prior epidemics, we may see a precipitous rise in non-coronavirus deaths in the coming months. Many will be health-related. Others, such as suicides or opioid overdoses, will occur because of economic and psychological disruption. What I'm trying to say is that, yeah, I think the coronavirus is an issue, but it's causing, in the healthcare sector, it's causing all sorts of problems. And I'll be honest with you, I don't know what the answer is. It's also having an economic impact. Now, my contention is, and there are plenty of economists that I've seen that would also say this, that when China shut down, the largest industrial supplier, and probably because people have let them become the main supply chain spoke or hub in the world, when they shut down everything for 75 days, that unleashed a financial contagion. When it hit the United States, we were in the midst of what appeared to be a great economy, but when you really look behind it, it was built on massive amounts of debt and borrowing, and it was a bubble. You cannot, listen, we have all complained as conservatives about deficit spending. The deficit spending has, in the last couple of years, has been over $1 trillion a year from the federal government. We have unfunded liabilities in the United States at state, at federal, state, and local government levels for pensions and health care and that type of thing that aren't funded, that total over probably $220 trillion. We have a annual GDP of, I think, $24 trillion. This is not sustainable on an economic basis. And so what you're going to see is, just like we saw back in 2008, 2009, a bubble burst. Now the bubble has burst. It was a bigger bubble. It took less of a pinprick to burst it, and the carnage is horrible. That started when China shut down. Now, certainly the coronavirus response with the lockdowns, the shutdowns, whatever you want to call them, has caused problems. And just look at some of these headlines. Sales of U.S. stores hit catastrophic depths with industry frozen. Aid finances run dry for small businesses as program falls short. You could apply for, I think they set aside $340 billion for small business administration loans, which most of which would be forgiven if you met certain criteria and you kept your employees employed. There was the Paycheck Protection Program. There's the CARES Act. There's all sorts of programs. But the one that the SBA was administering has run out of money. They don't have any more money. And I think there's some efforts to increase that. But that's eventually, some of that's going to be forgiven. But that money just doesn't appear out of thin air. It's somebody's printing it someplace. And that could have an impact down in the future. College is running low on money. Worry students will vanish too. So some colleges are very dependent on yearly tuition that they charge. They don't have the multi-billion-dollar endowment fund of, say, a Notre Dame or a Harvard or a Yale. They don't have a big endowment, and they run based on student tuition and room and board. Well, now you're in a situation where they're having to refund room and board for the year that just took place. And colleges, I don't have any specific examples, but I can assure you that a lot of colleges are running out of cash. And I think you will see a lot of colleges fail. And people are saying, well, why should I go to college if I can't finish out the year? Everybody's upset. I think there's been lawsuits filed because they're not having I don't get to walk in graduation. I don't have the college experience. I just barely had time to go on spring break this year. And by the way, I know of a person, a professional in, I won't say where, whose child went to spring break, came home, this professional caught the coronavirus and spent many days on a ventilator. And they finally gave him, I think, chloroquine and or however you say it, that drug, and Z-Pak and some other things. And he got better within hours. He was better. But he was virtually on the verge of death. But part of it was the child went to spring break and brought it home. And this was what everybody said was a problem. And we're seeing there's just all sorts of things. I mentioned earlier that people can't go to the hospital or the nursing home to be with a child or a parent. You can't even go to funerals. I saw a story the other day of a lady in New York who's, I'm trying to think if it was New York, it was somewhere in the Northeast. Her son, who was about 62, caught the coronavirus. She was in her 80s. Her son caught the coronavirus and died at home. His 20-year-old son, her grandson, died the next day from the same thing. And so there was a picture of her standing between the caskets of her kids. And hardly anybody else from the family at the funeral. And this is just so bizarre and beyond the scope of human experience. These headlines: broad shutdown pushes Americans to economic edge. In a system with no shock absorbers, basic needs are suddenly at risk. Companies are not doing well. Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, Bank of America, JP Morgan Chase. Look at the decline in their net income, down 46%, 46%, 45%, 69%. JP Morgan Chase had to put $9 billion in bad loan reserves. Now, right now, there's money coming into the system. People are tapping out their credit lines. But when everything starts to open back up again, there are going to be a lot of problems with loans at banks that aren't being paid. And the bank's going to have to evaluate whether they're going to keep this person on. I was talking to somebody who owns a fast food chain of restaurants, owns some franchises. And he was lamenting the fact that I just remodeled all of my stores for tables of 10. How is that going to work when things open back up and they may have restrictions on social distancing in restaurants? This is the Beige Book. This is a weekly publication put out by the Federal Reserve. And essentially what it says is, we've got a problem. It's not going away anytime soon. We have interviewed businesses in each of our different regions in the Federal Reserve system. And you can see a map there of them on the left. And what we are told across the board is, we're preparing for things to get much, much worse. Now, I know that's not good news, but it is what it is. Here's a headline from the Financial Times the other day. Virus threatens to hit economy harder than war and flu in 1918. So, it's a problem. Now, let's talk a little bit about oil. So, the economy's in the tank, and I don't think it's going to improve anytime soon. I don't know that it will ever go back to what we were. And I've talked to a lot of people in commercial business and banks and all sorts of things. It is a big mess. So let's talk about oil for just a moment. One of the things that happened back in January when China shut down was that China's demand for oil, and China has very little oil production on its own. It has to import virtually everything. When China shut down, its demand for oil dropped somewhere between 30 and 50% almost overnight. People were home. They weren't driving. I showed you statistics on the fact that people just aren't driving. And if you've gone out and driven around, and you know, I've seen pictures of Baltimore and Houston and Los Angeles at rush hour, and it's the lack of traffic and cars on the highway is unlike anything that I've ever seen, any time that I've been there. And sometimes even in the middle of the night, you will see much more traffic than what you're seeing right now at rush hour in a lot of cities. In some places, miles driven in some towns, especially in the Northeast, are down 90%. That has an impact on oil. So what happened was Russia and Saudi Arabia decided we needed to protect our market share. We're going to pump more oil. We're going to pump more oil, and we're going to lower the price, and we're going to pump a lot of oil because it's cheaper for us to produce it than any other countries in the world, and therefore we'll sort of protect our revenue. But what happened was the oil price cratered. So last week there was a big deal between OPEC and other oil producers in the world to cut output by about 10 million barrels per day. The problem is that that's not going to do anything to protect the price of oil, because the demand for oil is now down 30 million barrels per day. So with the result is that they're still pumping 20 million barrels per day more than anybody wants. There's a certain amount of storage built up in the system. The United States will fill its strategic oil reserves within the next few weeks, and then they won't have any place to store oil. There are pipeline companies that come out of Texas and transmit oil and gas and other things. There's a huge network of pipelines in the United States. And they're saying, look, you cannot put your oil in or your product into our pipeline unless you have a paid-for contract on the other end, because they're afraid, the pipeline companies, that people will use the pipelines as a place to store the oil that they continue to pump because it's too expensive to shut down the well, but they don't have any storage facilities left. So they think, well, maybe we can get some in the pipeline and worry about it later. And now the pipeline companies are saying, no, you can't do that. Well, all of that continues to have a spiral down. So you'll see these little spikes of the oil price, even the stock prices going up. Pretty good week in the markets this week, relatively speaking. But I think the analogy that somebody used with me is that these economic things, ups and downs, are going to be like a basketball bouncing down a flight of stairs. It goes down to the next step, it'll bounce up a little bit, down, bounce up, and eventually it comes to rest at the bottom. And I probably shouldn't even say what some of the financial analysts I've talked to have told me about where they think the stock market will end up. It's not good. Oil drillers shut wells as demand dries up. These are things that have just never happened before. Global supply deal fails to jolt oil market as crisis weighs on prices. Here's another one. Traders doubt supply cuts enough. Thirst for crude vanishes. And there you can see that chart. The chart there in the one article on the right, lower right-hand corner says this. They're down 25, 30 million barrels per day in demand. And cutting at 10 million barrels a day isn't going to do anything. And these are things that have never been seen before. And what this article, one of these articles says, global oil consumption is on course to plunge by about 35 million barrels a day in April. As the coronavirus outbreak moves across the world and leads to travel restrictions and work stoppages, oil consumption is expected to collapse by as much as 30 million barrels a day this month. The supply and demand fundamentals are horrifying, said OPEC Secretary General Mohamed Barkindo. He said the decline in the second quarter alone would be close to 12 million barrels a day and expanding, which is unprecedented in modern times. And another quote, the global oil industry is experiencing a shock like no other in its history. And here's a picture. This is a intersection, a freeway interchange in Los Angeles. That's what it looked like about 2 months ago. And I don't seem to have the other photo. Anyway, there's hardly any cars in that interchange. And I've been through that interchange, one of the major freeway intersections in Southern California, and it's never like that. It's never like that. Here's again what I said, global oil storage close to being overwhelmed. Traders get ready. And you're seeing more and more of these articles. Traders get ready for oil prices below zero. And in fact, some crude oil that's hard to refine, like Wyoming sulfur oil, It takes a lot of work to refine it because of the sulfur content. Some of those oil types are now trading below zero. These are things that have never been seen before. And this shows the crude oil inventories. It's the storage is just about completely full. Here's a guy who had, he has four cylindrical tanks in Cushing, Oklahoma, the main pipeline and trading hub in North America, were less than half full earlier this year. Now he said he expects them to be filled by this month's end, and when it fills, pipelines from the Permian Basin and Gulf Coast will have to order shippers to stop adding crude. The system, Mr. Fox said, will reach its limit. Nothing is available. If there's nowhere to go in Cushing, if the pipelines are full, now we're backed up to the producer. And it just says it's going to be a major problem. So here's an example. This is a traffic counter on I-95 at the Georgia-Southern California border. I was there a couple of years ago. Traffic was horrible. It was in the middle of the day, in the middle of the week. And it was, and now you see that traffic at that state border crossing is down almost 80%. Here's the drop in crude demand chart that I was referencing, oil down 12, 25, 30, 35 million barrels per day. Even in the North Sea, they're talking about a panic as the pandemic rips up the perfect storm for North Sea oil, which is a major revenue and tax producer for the UK. And what they're finding is, you know, that there's a complete drop. They're not putting any new wells in. They're not drilling anymore. Everything is shutting down. The International Energy Association predicts worst year in the history of the oil sector. All of this has an impact. Now let's look at some of the numbers with regard to travel. And I just want you to understand, I know this is very troubling. And I know it's not very comforting, because I can tell when people write me emails that they're having trouble dealing with it. And I don't know that I'm very comforting when I say, well, what did you expect the end times to look like? Now, that doesn't mean we should fear. And I understand other people are way more impacted by this than I am. I know people that lost their jobs this week. It's a big problem. But look at some of these numbers on the percent change in the volume of seats. So in the U.S., down 60%, China 49%, India 61%, Japan 49%. So the airline usage is going down, and this is based on numbers that haven't caught up to reality yet. And now in the lower left-hand corner, I have some stats that I want to show you. Down 95%. The percentage change in passengers at New York airports compared with comparable days last year. Traffic down 95%. And if you've ever been to Newark or LaGuardia or JFK, they're some of the worst airports in terms of congestion. And I mean, I've been at LaGuardia many times. If the flights are backed up because of weather, there's no place to sit down in the whole airport. In fact, I used to take a larger briefcase when I traveled to LaGuardia because I knew that I may need to use it as a seat. The number of Airbus A380s, according to the association that tracks it, 242 of these huge jumbo jets have been delivered in the world and are used by airlines. They can seat over 500 passengers, maybe up to 550, depending on how they're configured. Not 550 people like me, but there are, out of 242 delivered, six are still flying. And that won't last long. And they cost a lot of money. The number 90,510 was the number of passengers screened nationwide by TSA on April 12 at checkpoints in all airports in the United States. The same day a year ago, same day of the week, TSA screened 2.4 million people. 2.4 million to 90,000. It's just, it's an incredible thing. 5% is the percentage of passengers Delta is flying compared with its normal load. And here's air traffic, passenger loads travel down 84% to even more. And these are a little bit old numbers. I'm sure they're down less. And here's an interesting one. Pastor Steve, you spent part of your life growing up on Oahu, and you know that the tourist economy is pretty big in Hawaii. It is the backbone of that economy. Hotel occupancy on Oahu the week of March 31st to April 6th, which is usually a spring break week, was 7%. In fact, it was the lowest of any major metropolitan area in the entire country. These are shocking numbers. And so I thought this was a great graphic that I saw. I don't remember where I saw it, about, you know, that little Newton's cradle that, you drop one ball and it hits and knocks the other ones. And this is exactly what's happening with the world, because it's affecting global politics, governance, all sorts of things. What seems to us to be abnormal, the new abnormal, is this. Let me just talk about this. This is some practical advice. I think it would behoove you to go out and make some reasonable preparations in terms of meat and that type of thing, because the supply chain is being interrupted. And I know everybody wants to go to work, but here's part of the problem. Smithfield is a large producer of meat. There are a number of other large producers of meat in the United States. They are considered essential businesses. They've been open, they've been running, they've been processing meat. There's a Smithfield plant in South Dakota that's maybe the largest meat processing plant in the world. The workers work in very close quarters there, and they've had a major outbreak of the coronavirus, and the plant is shut down. So I'm just telling everyone that we think that we're going to open back up and everything is going to be okay. You know, there's a lot of employee liability concerns that employers have, that if a lot of people are coming to work and getting sick, they have to take steps. So here we have meat processing plants shut down everywhere. I saw another article this morning, because of the disruption in the food chain, because some of these meat processing plants have shut down, a chicken plant, they can't get they're closed, and the farmers have these hens and chickens that are ready to go, and I see in one place they had to euthanize 2 million chickens. So this will have a ripple effect in the meat supply and grocery supply. There are other places, I think this article from Europe, Europe farm worker shortage puts harvest at risk in southern Europe. Even in places in England, it's time to harvest. They usually have migrant workers that do this, but the migrant workers can't get there. And so they're short, and if you add up the numbers that they need, they may be short 35 or 40,000 workers. And you just don't go out and get 35 or 40,000 workers immediately overnight. And if they can't get the harvest out of the field, the harvest does not make it to market. That affects the food supply. And it's this sort of chain. And again, the economic thing, the unemployment claims in the U.S., and I think these are also tracking in almost every country in Europe. In the last 4 weeks, 22 million jobless claims in the United States. And everybody I talk to on the economic side says this number is not the half of it. So some of it is, at least initially, the Paycheck Protection Program is keeping some people with some cash and that type of thing, but as these food chains are disrupted and supply chains, it does not look that good. And here's, for example, pandemic ravages China's economy. This headline from the Wall Street Journal. Their GDP dropped almost 7%, which is unprecedented in the experience of China over the last 40 years. It's been growing at a pretty good clip. Here you see their retail sales are down, residential property sales, fixed asset investments are down. It's a major problem. Another thing that China has done through their Belt and Road Initiative and other things is they have Not only have they seeded money into American universities that gets them access to intellectual property and also good press and publicity, they're all about propaganda. They have also made major loans to different countries. One country, for example, they financed a giant dam down in Ecuador, which uses mostly hydroelectric power. And my understanding is that because of design flaws and everything, they have a major problem on their hands. The dam really can't produce electricity like they said, or they proposed that it was going to. And it's, but China wants to be paid for the loan, for the billions of dollars that they put into it. And that's what they do, is they go in, they make these loans, then the company can't pay back the loan, and China comes in and scarfs up all the assets. And China's been out there in the U.S. market, my understanding is, through shell companies, investing heavily in buying U.S. stocks because the stocks are way down. So here's just a little interview that Ian Bremmer did with the ambassador of China to the U.S. And I just want you to listen to a couple minutes of this to kind of get an idea. So, well, just listen to what the ambassador has to say.
So we are trying very hard to prevent any so-called second wave of the confirmed cases. And we are making our great efforts to restart the economic engine, to restore things to normal economic and social activity. This is a tremendous task. But at the same time, we are fully aware that we cannot succeed all by ourselves. We have to contribute to international efforts, international cooperation globally to combat this virus.
You have seen President Trump recently say that the Chinese numbers are a little on the light side. And then most recently, we saw news of a classified U.S. intelligence report that concluded that the Chinese government actually concealed the extent of the virus outbreak. How do you respond to those direct accusations by the U.S. government?
The fact is, we started daily briefing to the press in the very early stage of this crisis. And everything we learned from our own experience, we shared with the world. We even publicized all the possible treatments for the accusation that China is hiding the numbers. Just think about it. We have such a huge population, such a big country. You cannot hide the cases of such a...
Okay, I'll play another little clip. I don't believe anything this guy is saying. China is all about propaganda.
You've said a few times already, so I understand this is a clear priority for you, that it's a global crisis. We need global cooperation to respond. We don't see a lot of coordination, either political, economic, monetary, or on the healthcare side. We see individual countries responding individually. What do you think concretely the Chinese can do to help facilitate a more international response?
I think you are right. Of course, we have to recognize the G20 had a good special summit, also a video call, and they have taken a number of good decisions. Now the task is to implement these decisions. But still, I think the current situation and the current deficiencies in global governance, I hope will make people give more serious thinking to your idea of this G0. You see, I think we have had a number of crises in this 21st century, maybe starting with the terrorist attacks, 9/11, then the financial crisis, now COVID-19 virus. If we can still call this a wake-up call, I think we should have waked up long, long time ago. But still, we have to, if we have not started yet, we have to start real efforts to build a good international governance system for the 21st century, for the future.
And so what you see is you know, regardless of your view of the virus, whether it's a problem or a fake or made up, regardless, people are rushing in to take advantage of that situation from a global governance standpoint. And China, I think there's increasing evidence that China might be lying. Here's just a brief report that Brett Baer had the other night. And you're seeing more and more people talk about that this really came from a lab in China. Now the question is whether it was intentional or unintentional. But here's the report from Fox.
Have new information tonight that you heard John Roberts ask about the origins of the coronavirus. Multiple sources say this may be the costliest government cover-up of all time by China. The belief now, you heard the chairman of the Joint Chiefs asked about it, that the intelligence was inconclusive, but there is a growing belief that the COVID-19 virus originated in the Wuhan lab, not as a bioweapon, but as China's effort to find and deal with viruses to show the world China was as good as or better than the U.S. on that front. It's believed that the virus was bat to human, and then the human, patient zero, worked at the lab, went into the population in Wuhan, and the virus quickly spread from there. China, according to sources, moved quickly to shut down travel domestically from Wuhan to the rest of China, but did not immediately stop international flights from Wuhan. These sources say the World Health Organization was complicit from the beginning, helping China cover its tracks.
So that's, and there's a lot of, President Trump has talked about, I think he's cut off funding to the World Health Organization. So here's another guy who's pushing for global governance. This is Financial Times interview with Emmanuel Macron, and says it's time to think the unthinkable, that maybe it's over for Europe. He views it as a existential crisis to the European Union. There's many other European Union leaders that would be in the globalist camp that are saying the same things. And you can find that article at Financial Times. I think you should read it, because I think regardless of your view about where the Antichrist comes from, Europe is certainly an important part of the regions of the world that will be active in the end times. And here you see calls for governance, maybe reconfiguring the EU with a smaller group of countries. So you might want to look that up. There's also COVID-19 hits European countries worse than the U.S. President Trump talking about opening. Now, a very interesting thing happened last Sunday. The Pope gave his address, and I'm not endorsing anything that the Pope says at all. But this is you can find it referenced in an article, American Magazine, which is a Jesuit publication. What the Pope did was he sent out a letter to all of these different activist groups, social justice, left-wing activist groups around the world, saying, if I could paraphrase, and this is his Easter, this is his Resurrection Sunday message, and what he thinks is important to do is to take advantage of the situation to enact structural changes in the countries in which these people are active. Here's a quote from the letter that he sent out. This may be the time to consider a universal basic wage, which would acknowledge and dignify the noble essential tasks you carry out. It would ensure and concretely achieve the ideal, at least at once so human and so Christian, of no worker without rights. This man is a leftist. I hope that at this time of danger will free us from operating on automatic pilot, shake our sleepy consciences, and allow a humanist and ecological conversion that puts an end to the idolatry of money and places human life and dignity at the center. So let me paraphrase what he said. Get rid of the idolatry of money and make an idol out of yourself. And again, I do think he's a significant player. As I said so many times, he's more leftist than Catholic, and a lot of Catholics are increasingly recognizing that. This is a report, just briefly mention it. This is from a Palestinian Watch organization of Palestinians that looks at how Palestinians are treated in Arab countries, particularly in Syria. And what this report is saying is, like, we have this horrible refugee camps in Yarmouk was one of them in Syria. We have them in Lebanon. We have them in Jordan. And the conditions are horrible. They're worse than anything in the Palestinian refugee areas of Israel. but nobody ever focuses on this. And so whenever you're having a discussion with somebody who's talking about the indignities of the occupation, Israeli occupation, they'll use that type of language, ask them, what are you doing about the refugee camps that have been there for 50, 60, 70 years? Yarmouk was, I think, formed in 1957. Some of them are from 1948, so some of them have been around for 72 years, and the conditions are horrible. I may do a midweek update this week, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. But ask these people, what do you ever complain about that? Do you ever complain about the Palestinians in prison in Syria that are being tortured? Do you ever wonder what happened to the 200,000 or 300,000 people that lived in this essentially 1 square mile or 1.5 square kilometer camp, one of the most densely populated places on the planet? What do you do about them? Where did they go? It's all rubble. Go look up Yarmouk, Yarmouk, and drone. Do Yarmouk drone, and you will see some of the most horrific things that have been done. This, and understand, Yarmouk is right in the city of Damascus. It can't be more than, I don't know, 2 or 3 miles from the geographical center of the city of Damascus, and it's just completely devastated. It's taken over by ISIS for a while. It's the interesting thing to do is ISIS is even kind of backing off now, because I guess their desire for jihad can be defeated by their concern about a particular virus. Again, here's a headline from Daily Telegraph: biggest economic shock in 300 years. And everything that I've seen would support those type of statements. It's pretty bad. Here's another interesting thing about China. They have big dams on the Mekong River, which is important to Laos and Vietnam and Thailand. And they are essentially shut off the water. They had a drought last year, and China had excess rain, but they had a drought down in Southeast Asia. And China's saying, well, you know, the water came to us first. This is the great humanitarian China that's sending out defective face masks and everything. They're cutting off water to their neighbors, and it's a major crisis. So, a world of hardening borders. It seems like there's a rise right now of nationalism. Now, I'll just talk briefly about this. I mentioned it early on. Again, everybody's talking about the mark of the beast and surveillance and all this stuff. And people have been expressing these concerns for a while. We talked about Wired magazine had an article on the social credit system that was developing at that time in China. And now everybody says, well, we got this health crisis. We need to know whether you have immunity or you have the antibody and whether people around you have it. So we're going to do this. And even, I mean, I see this in the Washington Post. I see this in the New York Times. I see the Wall Street Journal. I see this in every paper. They're like, we're not so sure we really want this. But Google and Apple have worked together. Here's what the article in the Wall Street Journal says yesterday. I think it was Thursday. Governments are imposing new digital surveillance tools to track and monitor individuals. Many citizens have welcomed tracking technology intended to bolster defenses against the novel coronavirus. Yet some privacy advocates are wary, concerned that governments might not be inclined to unwind such practices after the health emergency has passed. Goes on to talk about what they did in Asia. And in Asia, when they did this in Singapore, they did it in South Korea, they did it in Japan. By the way, Japan has now declared a national state of emergency because they're expecting a second wave of the virus there. They've essentially shut down like the far northern island, what's it called, Hokkaido, where Sapporo, where they had the Olympics many years ago, is located. About 5 million people live on that island, and it's essentially cut off from the rest of Japan. They're locking everything down again. Now, the Japanese are not going along too well with it, but the government is trying to do it, and they've declared a national emergency as well. But one of the concerns was when they used cell phone location, and they tied your diagnosis to your cell phone in South Korea. I think one example is that they used in this article. They said it's going to be anonymous. Nobody will ever be able to figure it out. But what happened was all the people that lived around a lady who was diagnosed with the virus, and told to stay at home in her apartment. They sent warnings to all the people around her that, hey, there's somebody that lives around you that has the, you know, COVID-19, and, you know, you need to be careful. And it, she said it took about 2 hours till everybody had figured out that it was her, and they started posting it on all their social media accounts. So there's very this notion that this will be private is just an absolute joke. We live in a surveillance society. Here's Vladimir Putin looking at some technical aspects of tracking that they're doing in Russia because of an outbreak of coronavirus there. Doesn't really get into the press that often. The Wall Street Journal article again says this: security professionals say the coronavirus crisis could become a watershed moment similar to the September 11 terrorist attacks, which ushered in new government surveillance powers around the world in the name of protecting public safety. Jim Harper, an original member of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security's Data Privacy and Integrity Advisory Committee, said that once such surveillance powers in place, they rarely recede and can be repurposed as a political tool. And for example, here's some of the information that the cell phone companies have been providing to governments. Look at Singapore, almost everything is checked. Hong Kong, South Korea. Actually, the lady that I think had the problem with everybody identifying her lived in an apartment in Hong Kong. UK less, Germany and US have better privacy protections so far. It's going to be a major problem. Okay, this, oh, I guess it was a South Korean coronavirus patient. I forgot I had a. So it's a major problem. So here's what Google and Apple have done. They've joined together and say they've come up with this specification and white paper as to a contact tracing app that they want. And they assure us everything will be anonymous and your privacy will be protected. And I will tell you that I'm highly skeptical of those claims. And everybody will be sold on it. This will be a good idea. It'll be a great idea for you to have. But I know what's going to happen is you're going to get an app. And what it's going to do is it's going to light up when it's going to buzz you whenever you're close to somebody who might have been diagnosed with the coronavirus. I'm confident that that's the case. Now, there was an interview with Bill Gates that was done by TED about a week or so ago, where he was talking about digital immunity certificates that people would get so they would be able to travel and interact in society. So first, I'm going to play you the version of the video that is now on the TED Talk YouTube channel. Then I'm going to play you the version of the video that the interview as it originally happened. So I want you to see what they left out. It'll be near the end. So here's Bill Gates with the founder of the TED Talks.
Eventually, what we'll have to have is certificates of who's a recovered person, who's a vaccinated person, because you don't want people moving around the world where you'll have some countries that won't have it under control, sadly. You don't want to completely block off the ability for those, you know, people to go there and come back and move around.
Bill, is your foundation helping to accelerate the manufacture of these self-tests? What are the prospects for really seeing scale in some of this testing soon? Not just in the U.S., but globally.
Yeah, our foundation.
Okay, so you see the video at the top. It kept going. And the video at the bottom was Gates. And it was, it stopped in the middle. So here's the video as it appeared on at the end, you'll hear what it was that they edited out. So here's the new video.
Eventually, what we'll have to have is certificates of who's a recovered person, who's a vaccinated person, because you don't want people moving around the world where you'll have some countries that won't have it under control. Sadly, you don't want to completely block off the ability for those, you know, people to go there and come back and move around. So eventually there will be sort of this digital immunity proof that, you know, will help facilitate the global reopening up.
So that's that last little part is what they cut out of that, to facilitate the global reopening up. And he's big that, you know, we're not going to reopen until we have a vaccine or these digital immunity certificates. And this is all part of this push towards identity tracking and that type of thing. This is also, I've talked a little bit about this. This is the strategic intelligence part of the World Economic Forum website. They have all sorts of different things that you can click on. Go to intelligence.weforum.org. You may have to register. One of the things they have is COVID-19, but look at some of the topics that they have. They have global governance. And when you click on, for example, the unsettled world thing of this website, it takes you to this tree, which has more articles that are linked and more articles. There's also a section for 5G. There's all sorts of, I mean, there's dozens and dozens of topics there. They all have a hub and spoke like this. They're all interconnected. All the links seem to work. So here under 5G is an article, the first one that comes up on the right, why this pandemic is different, a post-COVID-19 digital Bretton Woods. And so, a lot of these articles appeared just the other day, just on Friday. And so they keep populating it with all these articles and connections and links. And it's all built using our artificial intelligence. It's pretty impressive. And then here's this on COVID-19. And you'll see here the legacy of financial crises put up yesterday on Saturday. Here's 7 recommended reads for contextualizing COVID-19. Some of these articles are just, they're put up by the London School of Economics, which is a Fabian Socialist school in London. Here's a little bit more what the COVID-19 hub and spoke looks like. So this is concerning. And people are taking, this I think is a roadmap to how people want to change world governance. And so as Christians, I think this is something we should be concerned about. And look, they're not even hiding it anymore. It's pretty easy to obtain. And if you sign up for the free account, you can spend a lot of time there. I wouldn't recommend it, but it does show you the extent to which people are making plans to implement these programs. Now I'll finish with this. We talked last week about the quantum dot tattoo, and that it puts some dye in your skin that can be read by a cell phone camera. Might last 5 years. It will tell you if you have a particular vaccine. But it goes away after 5 years. And I personally don't think that's the mark of the beast because it's limited information, but it certainly shows technology that they can use for other things. And here's a patent application. Now, I've did a little digging around this. It's a patent application by Microsoft Technology for a device. It was filed in March 20th of this year. It's already being challenged by other companies or other patent holders saying, hey, wait a minute, this is nothing new. And I'm only pointing it out because it's just something that popped up recently. And it's called a cryptocurrency system using body activity data. You'll have a sensor, you'll interact with your cell phone, you'll be able to do economic activity. And this sounds a lot like what if could be used as the mark of the beast. Now, again, I don't know that this patent will make it through the patent review process, but it is a patent that was applied for, and there was a response. I'll show you that in a minute. But look at the patent number that it was assigned up there. W20202006 06 06 06. Now, sometimes I think that people in the world know that, 666 really freaks Christians out. And so sometimes I wonder if they're just trolling us, trying to see how freaked out we'll get. It could be that this is random. I think it might be. It's certainly a coincidence. When you look at the technology, like here's one of the drawings on how the technology works, sensor, user device, communication, and they have everything. You can find all this in the patent. And so here's this is a third party observation on the patent saying, look, this is nothing new. It's been around for a while. And you can go find it. I'm sure there's links all over the Facebook and every place by now. For how to get this, and it talks about how it works, all the details. And so this is something I think that's something that's concerning. And I will say there's one more. I think I have one more slide. Yeah. It's been very difficult for the United States to determine exactly what's going on in China. And I want to refer you back to a story that I talked about many years ago now. I don't even know what week I did. I think the reports started hitting like Foreign Policy Journal magazine and other foreign analysis magazines back about 2016 as the Obama administration was going out. Back in 2010 through 2012, when the U.S. State Department was under the control of a person named Hillary Clinton, somehow China got into and hacked the communication system that the intelligence services here in the United States use to communicate with intelligence assets on the ground in China. From everything that I've been able to read on it, there was at least a dozen to three dozen were killed by the Chinese. That effectively gutted our intelligence operations in China with these well-placed assets that had been cultivated over a long period of time. And that happened in the under the Obama administration and the Clinton State Department. I think they kept it sort of under wraps until, I don't remember if it came out during the 2016 election race or not. There were certainly a lot of other distractions at the time. So listen, the new abnormal, or as Michael Ramirez in his editorial cartoon the other day said, Brave New World. We really live in a time of epic global change, geopolitical disruption. I would describe it as an economic catastrophe. But listen, God's not given us the spirit of fear, but of a sound mind. Pray for a sound mind and use it. Well, some people just sit there and send me articles all day, bless their hearts. But sometimes I think maybe you ought to go read your Bible. It's on the internet too, by the way. Bible Gateway and everything. It's free. There's all kinds of, there's other tremendous Bible apps out there. They're linked with articles. Blue Letter Bible has links to the concordances of the original languages, help you in your Bible study. Also has links to audio and written commentaries to help you understand. So take advantage of those. Eventually we'll be able to figure this out. Sometimes we will not figure this out until we can operate with 20/20 hindsight. But God's in control and Jesus is coming. I know that. And I take great comfort in that. Help people out. There are a lot of people out there right now that are hurting tremendously and need people to minister to them. Assuming you maintain proper social distance. It is such a weird world. I did play golf yesterday, everybody in their own cart. And at the end, we usually shake hands. And so now we're tapping putters. And it's a strange world. But Jesus is coming. Let's pray. Father, pray that you'll comfort us at this time. Give us wisdom. Give us a sound mind. Help us to understand the things that are going on in the world and how they relate to what your prophets told us would happen in the end times. Bless us this week. In Jesus' name, amen.